Today is February 8th, Sunday morning. We're learning Mishnah, Masechet Pesachim. It's Erev Tu B'Shvat, which means it's the fourth day of the month of Shvat. Only another month until Purim, and exactly 2 months until Pesach. Right? Time is getting close. So we said we're in chapter 10 of Masechet Pesachim. We're in Mishnah 3. What we're going to do is we're going to spend most of our time in the third Mishnah, Mishnah Gimel. And if we have time, I'm not sure if we will, we'll go back and look at some of the Talmudic passages that we could have seen last week on the first two Mishnayot and we didn't get to. I'm not sure if we'll have time, therefore we're not starting with that. We want to at least finish Mishnah Gimel, the third Mishnah today. So we'll read the Mishnah. Hiviu lefanav mitabel b'chazeret ad shemagia leparperet apat. Literal translation, they brought before him, comma, he dips ba chazeret. Chazeret is to be translated as chasa, lettuce, romaine lettuce. He dips with romaine lettuce, ad shemagia lefarperet hapat, until he arrives or gets to parperet hapat. I'm not going to translate parperet hapat. Hiviu lefanav matzah v'chazeret v'charoset u'shnei tavshilin. They brought before him matzah and romaine lettuce and charoset, we know what that is, and shnei tavshilin, two dishes, two foods. By the way, those words, two foods, are not in all of the manuscripts. They're missing from some manuscripts. Those words, ushnei tavshilin. Af al pi she'ein charoset mitzvah, even though that charoset is not a mitzvah. Rabbi Elazar bar Tzadok omer, mitzvah. In other words, Rabbi Elazar bar Tzadok says that haroset is a mitzvah. Uvemikdash hayu mivim lefanav gufo shel Pesach. And in the mikdash, they would bring before him the carcass of the Pesach. In other words, the body of the roasted lamb. So let me read the whole thing again in Hebrew and then I'll read it again in English. Hiviu lefanav mitabel b'chazeret ad shemagia lefarperet apat. Hiviu lefanav matzah v'chazeret v'haroset u'shnei tavshilin af al pi she'in haroset mitzvah. Rabbi Elazar bar Tzadok omer, mitzvah. Uvemikdash ayu mivim lefanav gufo shel haPesach. They brought before him. He dips with lettuce before he gets to the parperet hapat. They brought before him matzah and lettuce and haroset and two dishes, even though haroset is not a mitzvah. Rabbi Elazar bar Tzadok says it's a mitzvah. And in the temple, they would bring before him the carcass of the Pesach. That's the Mishnah.
The first time you translated, until lefaperet...
Until he gets to parperet hapat.
Okay, but this time you said before. Until and before...
Same thing.
Okay.
First, when I said until he gets to, I was giving a little literal translation. When I said before, I was making it a little bit more clearer. I didn't do that on purpose, but...
They don't make the distinction in Hebrew between that.
Yeah. Okay. So let's remember the context. The first Mishnah had talked about what happens on Erev Pesach and about preparations for the Seder, that you shouldn't eat before the Seder until it gets dark. and that you should have a place prepared for Haseva, that the whole night, once you begin eating, you're going to be doing it b'haseva. And it also said that you should have prepared 4 glasses of wine, even from the community chest, for the poorest of the poor. So the first Mishnah talked about Erev Pesach and about the preparations for the Seder. The second Mishnah, Mishnah Bet, that began with the words at the top of the left-hand column, Mazgulo Chos Rishon, they poured from the first glass, so that's the beginning of the Seder. We're going now from Erev Pesach to the Seder itself, beginning with Kiddush, the first glass of wine. Which means that this chapter of Mishnah goes according to the order of events from Erev Pesach to the Seder itself, and it will go through the order of the Seder, the Seder of the Seder.
The Haggadah.
It basically is the prototype of the Haggadah as we know it today. Beginning, like we said, after Erev Pesach with Kiddush. And then our Mishnah begins the Seder proper after Kiddush by saying, Hiviu Lefanav. The first two words of the Mishnah are Hiviu Lefanav. They brought before him, and it doesn't say what. It doesn't say what. So let's look at the instructions that I prepared. And the beginning of the instructions say that even before trying to deal with our Mishnah, we should look at Chapter 2, Mishnah 6 of Masechet Pesachim. And I brought that on the back of the page.
Well done. And back to that, it should be.
And actually here, I changed my method, and I'll ask you guys what you think. Until this time, I'd always been photostatting extra sources from the original book, so you could get the feeling of the book. And now, I just took a snippet from my computer program. And I never did that in the past because I always thought that I was robbing you of the opportunity to see the context. Not necessarily that you'd look at the words, but you just get the form of the page and get a feeling for it. So the question is going to be, I guess you can think of it that, is there a big loss in doing it this way? You can express an opinion now, express an opinion later.
It doesn't matter much to me.
We have other opportunities to go.
Okay, so we heard two or two opinions?
I like the other way, but I wouldn't necessarily demand that we do it every time. You know, I mean, you maybe interchanging it, you know, so that there's...
Okay.
I enjoy being able to learn a little bit, you know, on the page where things are located.
Right,
and try to,
yeah. Right, that was the purpose I was doing it, and I just got lazy. It also saves paper, of course.
I did.
Yeah, but I do think there's value, like you guys said. Okay. So anyway, here is a little snippet from Mishnah, Masechet Pesachim, Perek Bet Mishnah Vav. Okay? And it says, at the back of the page, it says, Ve'elu yerakot sha'adam yotzei behen yedei chovato bepesach bechaseret be'ulshin betamcha ubechar chaveina ubemaror. Translation. These are the yerakot, right? These are the vegetables. Shadam yotzei behen yedei chovato. We know that expression, that a man fulfills his obligation. B'Pesach.
Excuse me, where is this from? Where are we quoting from?
Masechet Pesachim, Perek Bet, Mishnah Vav.
Oh, this is another Mishnah.
Yeah. So this is a list of the 5 vegetables that you can use to fulfill your vegetable mitzvah on Pesach. So what's the vegetable mitzvah?
Maror.
Maror, right? What are the 5 vegetables that you can use for maror? And it lists them, and according to the commentators, they're listed in order of preference. But the problem is, we really don't know what these words refer to. In other words, botanically, we've lost the tradition.
Yeah.
We know what the first one is, of those 5 vegetables, chazeret, ulshin, tamcha, har chavina, and maror, we know at least one of them. Don't be confused by the fact that maror is one of the 5 vegetables. Maror is the name of a vegetable, but it's also the name of the mitzvah. That's confusing. Uh-huh. So anyway, the first one that says chazeret, that's hasa, in modern Hebrew, hasa, and in English it's romaine lettuce. The best thing the best vegetable is romaine lettuce. All of the other four, there's a little bit of a machloket. Kahati there explains his opinion, yeah, what they are. You wanna?
Oh, I was just leading the translation. Yeah. The Rashi brings the Loaz, the French on TV.
Yeah.
The Tamcha, Haramba Mefresh.
What about Olshin? I forgot. What is Olshin?
Olshin, Haramba Mefresh. Min Olshin, Hagdel.
So some say that tamcha is horseradish. Uh-huh. Some say it's not. But anyway, it's clear that chazeret means hasa. And that's romaine lettuce. Now, there's another confusing factor here, that in modern Hebrew, this is going to really throw you. In modern Hebrew, chazeret is horseradish.
Right.
Horseradish?
Yeah.
Chazeret in modern Hebrew, but in the Mishnaic Hebrew, chazeret is romaine lettuce. So that really is confusing.
Right, right, right.
It is confusing.
And then he explains what the harchavina means, semach kotani, like from a sharp plant.
A thorny plant.
Shebeodot sa'ir mishamesh ki yerek v'alav v'shrashav ne'echlim.
Yeah. I can tell you what the botanists say. The botanists say that the first one, ulshin, is endives, and that tamcha is chicory. I'm sorry, endives and chicory is the same thing. That's ulshin, and tamcha is picridium. And that harchavina is oregano. And maror is sonchus. So I actually looked, I looked on Wikipedia what sonchus is. And sonchus is so thistle, it's called. S-O-W, so thistle. Doesn't mean a lot, right?
Correct.
Doesn't mean a lot. Okay, but anyway, the point is for us that chazeret, which is romaine lettuce, is the preferable vegetable for maror.
Yeah.
That information is important when we go back to this sort of a paper, we go back to the Mishnah.
I have a question about that.
They
chose romaine lettuce for maror because they don't have maror.
What do you mean by that?
They don't have it. Maror is very bitter.
What is maror?
What is
maror?
Yeah.
No.
He's asking you what it is in English.
It's bitter leaf.
But botanically, what vegetable is it exactly? What would you call it in English?
Coriander.
You don't have it in the U.S.
No, but wait a second. There's a mistake. Mm-hmm. The mitzvah of maror
is mitzvah.
There's a mitzvah called maror, mm-hmm, which is a mitzvah to eat a bitter vegetable with the Korban Pesach and with the matzah. The question is, what vegetable should we use? There's lots of bitter vegetables out there.
That's what I'm saying.
So the Mishnah decide. There's no such thing as it, though. What do you mean, it?
You don't have the bitter herb, the bitter leaf, that is called maror. It doesn't exist in the U.S.
She's coriander.
For real.
If it's coriander.
I think that Rabbi Schlesinger is saying that, forget the United States and what we have here. He's saying that at Talmudic times, it wasn't clear what it was. He's not saying 100 years ago people of course developed customs.
Right.
And they did certain things and they said this is what's meant or that's what's meant. Am I saying it fairly? But according to the words of the Talmud at that time, they say they don't know for sure what was intended.
Well, I think that they're saying that nothing was intended. What was intended was any bitter vegetable.
Okay.
And they have, in their times, five bitter vegetables that they know of.
Yeah.
One of them is what we call romaine lettuce, which
is not bitter.
Which is very bitter if you take the green leaves without the stalk. At least to me, it's extremely distasteful to eat only the green leaves of the tips of the romaine lettuce. And according to the Mishnah, that's the preferable usage. I don't know why it's preferable. It could be because the other possible types of maror, the other possible vegetables used for maror, perhaps they weren't available so much, or perhaps they were too bitter, or perhaps they had worms in them. We don't know. The fact that Eastern European Jews have traditionally used horseradish, that's probably because they didn't have romaine lettuce in Eastern Europe. That's certainly true. Right, according to the Mishnah, even if one of the possibilities for maror is horseradish, it's not the first possibility.
Can I just note that I'm going to say, I know even during my short lifetime so far, the appearance and taste of vegetables has changed. Mm-hmm. Because the agricultural system improves, quote, improves the vegetables far to achieve certain characteristics of storage and shipping and longevity and appearance. Mm-hmm. And so we shouldn't judge what romaine lettuce tastes like now and say that's the taste they had then. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily true.
Very interesting.
And so, because to me, romaine lettuce also is not a bitter herb.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not anything, it's not in the same world as horseradish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't, we shouldn't think that that means because it was used then. It may have been very bitter in its character then.
I find that very interesting what you're saying.
The last example, the maror, when Rambam says that it is the bitter, it means kusbar, coriander, shahu, mar bioter.
Where an hour coriander is not so
I don't know. Is
bitter,
it,
right?
Bitter, I don't think.
I don't know coriander. I mean, I know that word, but
it's
I don't know what it is.
This,
coriander and cumin are very similar.
Okay, very interesting. Okay. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so now to the questions that we have concerning the Mishnah. The first question says, what is clearly missing from the phrase that is made up of the first two words of the Mishnah?
What did they bring them?
Right.
What did they bring?
What did they bring? It just says they brought before him. It doesn't say what. And that's so difficult and so awkward that some commentators suppose that there must be a problem with the text. Must be a problem with the text. Perhaps the original text that we have lost or something did say what they brought. Now, be careful. From reading on, it's possible to ascertain what they brought. But that still doesn't make the language any less awkward.
Right.
Because when you say they brought before him, even if you can ascertain from what comes later what they brought, it still should say what they brought. It, otherwise, just linguistically, it's quite awkward.
Are there texts that have Hevi lefanav yirakot v'chazeret?
Yes.
Okay.
So we turn to the back of the page, and we read the Mishnah as it appears in the Yerushalmi, in the Talmud Yerushalmi, which is the next source. In the source I brought, and it says Talmud Yerushalmi Masechet Pesachim Perek Yud, and this is just the same Mishnah, but it's from a different textual tradition. Remember that we have three different textual traditions of the Mishnah. Copyists during the Middle Ages copied the Mishnah as a separate text. They also copied the Mishnah as part of the Talmud Bavli. And they also copied the Mishnah as part of the manuscripts of the Talmud Yerushalmi. And they developed three different textual traditions. You know, during the course of thousands of years, errors creep in. So in the tradition of the printed Mishnah, it says, Hiviyu lefanav, stop. But in the Yerushalmi, the Mishnah says, Hiviyu lefanav yirakot v'chazeret. Now, the fact that the Yerushalmi says what they brought certainly makes our text less awkward. But that doesn't prove that it's the historically true text. And it might be that the text was originally edited in an awkward fashion, review lefanav, stop, and the Yerushalmi's copyist added in words to make it less awkward. So we still don't know which is the true text. We just know that there are two competing texts. One makes sense and one makes less sense. But one of my professors in university once said that usually the text that makes less sense is the more authentic text. And the one that makes more sense is the one that Hakapi is corrected to make it make sense. So you never know. Okay, so let's turn back to our questions and our study of the Mishnah.
What about the fact, it seems to me that also is missing, it doesn't say to whom it's brought. Now it's implicit it's brought to the Seder, to the place where we're having a Seder, but it doesn't explicitly say if it's just brought to Dad, to the person who's the leader of the Seder, or if it's brought to everybody.
Oh, that's a very good point.
Yeah, let's open up.
I don't know if you don't know probably, but you're actually asking the question at the beginning of a Talmudic passage. And there's a big machloket there. If it's brought, when I say it, I mean everything, mm-hmm. is brought before kol echad v'echad, each person, or only before orech et haSeder, the leader of the Seder. It's a question. Just notice that in the earlier Mishnah we read, Mishnah Bet, the first four words of the second column in the printing we're looking at, it says Mazgulo Kos Rishon. And also there it doesn't say Mazgulo, who is low? Right. And that's going to be throughout this whole chapter. It always says they did for him, they brought for him, but it doesn't say who him is. Now, of course, I would say the pshat is, that it could have said mazgu lahem, and it could have said hiviu lahem, but it doesn't. It always says hiviu lo. It seems to be one particular person. But certainly in the time of Talmud, there were customs that they brought before kol echad v'echad, as opposed to customs that also existed, they brought only before the leader of the Seder. Okay, so back to the Mishnah. It says, Hiviu lefanav, they brought before him, and it doesn't say what they brought before him. And then it says, Mitabel bachazeret. He dips ba, I'm not going to trust that for a second, ba.
With
or in, chazeret. And chazeret, we said, means romaine lettuce. So I want to point out the theoretical ambiguity of the preposition bet. To dip be can be to dip with or to dip in. And you only know what it means from the noun chazeret. Chazeret being not a liquid and not a mush but a solid, romaine lettuce. So you know that you're dipping with. But the minute you say dipping with, you ask the question, into what? It doesn't say. Right? So you dip with chazeret, and we don't know into what. So what we just talked about are my questions 2, 3, and 4 in the question sheets. I was able to expand one sentence into three questions. But anyway, it does seem clear that we're dipping with the lettuce into something. So I can ask everyone on the table, what do we dip it into in our custom today?
Salt water,
right? Yeah. Some people use vinegar. And today we don't use lettuce, but rather we use what? Your Seder.
Celery, usually.
Celery.
Use potato.
Some use potato, right.
Yeah, we use potatoes. So.
Potato, uh-huh. So it appears that this Mishnah is telling us that the tibul rishon, the first dipping, we don't know what it's dipped into, but the dipping is done with chazeret, with romaine lettuce, which should set off a red light bulb in our minds. Because mm-hmm. we just read in the Mishnah chapter Bet that chazeret is the best vegetable to use for maror, mm-hmm. which only comes later in the Seder. So why are we using it now to dip for the first dipping, for the tibul rishon, which is not connected to maror? Right? That's a question. That's a problem. Okay. Now we're going...
You can even say a bracha on it. If you've already done it, you wouldn't say a bracha.
Right. If you say the bracha on maror now, you won't say it later. But...
And if you've already eaten it now, you can't say the bracha later. You've already eaten it.
That's
That's what I was trying to say.
So David, you have gotten your second gold star for today, because that's a long, long commuted passage. That gets pretty complicated. Yeah. Things are complicated. Okay. So now, I'm asking question five, as we move on to the expression, Ad Shemagia Lefaperetapat, until he arrives to the Paperetapat. My question five is, what is pat?
Bread.
You said bread.
Bread. That's what we learned in Masechet Brachot. But could it be bread? Could it be bread?
It's anything with flour and water, I think.
Right.
Matzah.
It has to mean matzah.
Matzah.
Because no one has bread on the Seder table.
Yeah, there's a pas.
My parents have bread on the Seder table, but that's not what it's talking about here.
Right? So why doesn't it say matzah?
Why doesn't it say matzah? It doesn't say matzah because paperetapat is an expression. It has to do with something that has to do with the bread on the table. The bread is matzah in this point. And that reminds us that we've learned the expression paperetapat back in the sixth chapter, I think, of Masechet Brachot.
What does exactly mean the word paperet?
I'm asking you.
Appetizer.
It means
we learned it as appetizer.
Appetizer. Yeah.
Good.
Very good. That's the gold star of the year. And as we learned that paperetapat is anything that accompanies
the bread. The matzah. The matzah.
Yeah. Well, in this case, it's going to be the matzah, right?
Yeah.
Well, the truth is that Paul is right, but he didn't give the whole story. We actually learned that there are different types of parperot, different types of parperet. There's the parperet shelefnei hamazon, right? There's the parperet shacharei hamazon, and in the middle there's parperet tapat.
Mm-hmm.
When Paul said appetizer, he meant the parperet shelefnei hamazon. And if someone said dessert, that would be the parperet shela achar hamazon. Whereas here we're talking about parperet hapat, which is not appetizer, but which is rather
meal.
You have to be more specific.
With bread.
Right. It's the food that accompanies the bread. Yeah. Right. The gefilte fish and the salad is the parperet shela hamazon, and the apple pie is the parperet shela achar hamazon.
Right.
But the parperet hapat is the chicken and the corn and the potatoes and the vegetables. Anything, or in Talmudic times, the paperetapat would have been the hummus, right? What you dip your bread into, or what you wrap inside your bread. It would have been the falafel balls or the whatever it is that you literally eat inside or with your bread. So now we have to understand what the Mishnah is saying. It's telling us that we do this tibul, we do this dipping of our chazeret, of our romaine lettuce, in something, ad shemagia l'palperetapat, before he arrives to the palperetapat. So the palperetapat means the main meal, with the matzah, and whatever you eat together with the matzah. What do you eat together with the matzah on Leila Seder?
Maror.
Maror and?
Korban
Pesach.
Uh-huh. Right.
So the Mishnah is saying, basically, that you dip with maror before you get to the maror and the matzah and the Pesach.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Why would it be saying that? It's not an easy question I'm asking. It's a very difficult. Why would it say that you eat maror before you eat maror?
Don't think you're
because
fulfilling.
Huh? Sorry, I didn't hear you.
Don't think you're fulfilling the part of maror at this instant.
Okay. That certainly makes sense. That certainly makes sense. It's not the true answer, but it makes sense.
We actually do it right before the meal. We say the blessing on maror, the mitzvah of maror, and then we sandwich matzah.
But we also have the maror before that.
And now we first say the maror and eat it.
And eat it. Oh, yeah.
Sorry. And we say the blessing of the maror and eat it. Mm-hmm. And then we do what we call the Hillel sandwich, which is the...
Uh-huh. Okay, that's very true also.
Matzah and it's all the things together.
Yeah, but that can't help us. Let me tell you why. The reason we do what we do today, that first we have the matzah separate, then the maror separate, then we have the two of them together, because it's machloket of how together they have to be. Mm-hmm. So we do it twice. But both of them are a fulfillment of the mitzvat maror. Neither of them are a tibul or a dipping before the mitzvat maror. They're both mitzvat maror.
Why are you saying that the until you get to the lepaperet kapat is mitzvah maror? It doesn't say that.
I'm saying that because at the Seder, the pot is the matzah, and the palperet of the matzah is the maror, qua maror, as mitzvah maror.
Why are you saying that?
Why am I saying that? Because it says in chapter 12 of Shmot that al matzot umororim yuchluhu. You eat the korban Pesach with matzah and maror. They are a unit. The matzah with korban Pesach and maror are a unit. There's a machloket. How much of a unit? They have to be in the one bite, or just together, you know, within a few minutes. But there, clearly, the parperet of the pot on this night is the korban Pesach and the maror. That's true.
So I can't interpret this as saying, as a decision on that point, of saying first eat the maror separate. And then eat it with. That's in fact what we do.
You're right. That what you're saying bears a striking resemblance to what the text says. I agree.
It's just not related.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, but there's just no commentators that said that. So let me think if I can give a reason why. Because it's a good answer what you're saying. I think the answer of why you're wrong, I think, would be because even if you eat the maror separate from the matzahs we do today, it's still a parperet because it's still in the same framework, even though it's not literally in the same bite. Just like the potatoes that we have in a meal, a parperet of the pot, even in not eating them in exactly the same bite.
So am I reading this wrong? I think Bartonora says it was just the custom in that time that they would dip their food in things. That's the way they ate.
Okay, so that's a different question of why we have this first dipping. But I'm actually asking the opposite question. That's a good question also.
Right.
But the opposite question is as follows. It says they brought before him, he dips the chazeret in something. And the question I'm asking is, why does it have to indicate that you're dipping the chazeret in something? Why does it have to indicate and say, you're doing that before you got to parperatapat? Obviously, you're doing it before you got to parperatapat, because the Mishnah didn't yet describe the parperatapat. Everything's in order. Why did it have to tell you, ad shemagil parperatapat? It's not clear, and there's a lot of different opinions in the commentator. I'll just tell you what seems to be the main approach from the commentators, which is that Mitabel bechazeret is not telling you what you should do, it's telling you what you're allowed to do in a difficult situation. If you only have one vegetable available, romaine lettuce, which you've saved and you've collected and you've bought for maror, and you don't have a different vegetables for the tibul rishon, and the Mishnah is saying, according to many commentators, you're allowed to do the tibul rishon, the first dipping, with chazeret, even though we haven't yet arrived to parperet the pot. As you might say to yourself, I can't use the maror for something that's not maror. I was playing with words, but you can't use the chazeret for something that's not maror. So the Mishnah says, if it's all you have, then you use for tibul rishon, even chazeret, even though you haven't yet got to parperet the pot. Now that's going to cause us lots of questions with brachot, like David brought up earlier, which the Gemara deals with. How could it be that you're eating a vegetable that counts as maror before you get to maror? We won't talk about that now. But the point is, this is not what you're supposed to do, it's what you're allowed to do. What you're really supposed to do is mitabel with anything but chazeret. But if you only have chazeret, you can even be mitabel b'chazeret, even though we haven't yet gotten to parperet the pot.
There's two different blessings. One blessing you make boer pi adomu, and the other one you make boer alechilas maror.
You're right. But why should you not make the blessing of maror on the chazeret when you eat it? Because it does fulfill the mitzvah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the same as maror, yeah.
So what do you do? If you're eating it, but not for the purpose of maror, what blessing do you say? This gets into the whole machloket of, do mitzvot require kavanah? Just think of it. You're eating here chazeret, not for the purpose of maror.
Yeah.
And you say to yourself, this is not the mitzvah of maror.
Yeah.
Does it fulfill the mitzvah against your will?
Yeah.
Or does your will count? And this is one of the major places in the Gemara in which they discuss the question of, do mitzvot require kavanah? If you say mitzvot require kavanah, then eating romaine lettuce without kavanah for maror means you didn't do maror.
Yeah.
But if you say mitzvot don't require kavanah, then whether you were mitkaven or not, you fulfilled maror by eating the lettuce.
Or is it possible to have kavanah despite the reality that you're, you know, I mean, can you gin up the...
No, if you're eating cream cheese, you can't have kavanah for lox. It's just not. Unless you're...
You can't self... There's no self-deception. Or deceiving God.
Unless you can change cream cheese to lox. Okay. Let's now take the insight that we just suggested to the back of the page and fit it in to the language of the Yerushalmi. At the Yerushalmi there, we said, was the second source from the top of the page on the back.
Uh-huh.
And it said, Hiviu lefanav yirakot v'chazeret. They brought before him vegetables and chazeret. And it says, mitabel b'chazeret ad shemagila paperet apat. What we have to understand in Yerushalmi, it says, they brought before him vegetables or romaine lettuce. And if it was only romaine lettuce, then you're allowed to dip with romaine lettuce, even though you didn't yet get to maror. That's what we have to understand.
Oh, you translated it as or and not
as or, right, okay. Right. Because if it was and, then certainly you wouldn't dip with the chuzeret, you would dip with the vegetables. That's at least the assumption of the Gemara.
It says yirukos and chazeret.
Yes, we have to understand. It's this or that. They brought one or the other. If they brought yirukot, then you dip with the yirukot. But if all they brought was chazeret, then you're really in a bind. But what you can do is dip with the chazeret, even though you didn't yet get to the parperet, the pot.
That means necessity counts.
Say it again, please.
Necessity. Because what you have is what you use.
Right. Right. And by,
yeah.
By the way, let's remember that we shouldn't be surprised at this wording of the Mishnah. Because it's not rare that the Mishnah doesn't tell us basic halachot, but it tells us the rare cases. Because you know the basic halacha that you're supposed to dip. But the Mishnah comes to be mechadesh, comes to innovate to you, is that if you're in a bind, you can even use for the first dipping something that is prepared for the maror later. It's not rare that the Mishnah does that type of thing. It doesn't tell us what we already know. It tells us the little detail that we might not know. Okay. So now, we just did questions 7 and 8, and 9, and 10. We just did questions 7, 8, 9, and 10. And we're now going to read question 11. And you will laugh at me and say it's a ridiculously stupid and easy question, but it really does have significance, even though it is an easy question. Question 11. What is obviously done right after the tibul, but is not explicitly mentioned in the Mishnah?
Oh, eating it.
Eating it.
Yeah.
And you'll say, well, that's, of course, you eat it. But it's extremely important to notice that in this whole chapter, it never says to eat. Eating, apparently, is an assumed function. Look at the first Mishnah, I'm sorry, the second Mishnah. It said they poured from the first glass of wine. And I'm going back to the Mishnah. They poured before the first glass of wine. And in Beit Shammai says, you mevarech al this, and mevarech on that. And Hillel says, mevarech on that, mevarech on this. What do you do after the mevarech? You drink. Did it say you drink? It didn't say. But the assumption is that you drink after you say the brachot. And you say the brachot when you brought the food or the drink.
Yeah.
And it's going to be extremely important to realize that this whole chapter never tells you when to eat. The assumption is you eat when you have the food in front of you. That, again, is going to be essential to understand the foundation of this whole Mishnah. Okay. So now we get to question 12, which says, why would the haroset be a mitzvah? Remember, there's a machloket in the Mishnah. The Tanakhama says that haroset is not a mitzvah, which I guess means that haroset was something, and I just learned this last night when I was preparing, that haroset was something they had on their tables 365 days a year, a certain type of vegetable mash that they simply used to dip their food in. We have a special haroset for the Seder, but they always had a type of food that was called haroset. And we also have that haroset here this night. It says the Tanakhama, it's not a mitzvah, but you can bring it to dip your food in. But Rabbi Elazar ben Bar Tzadok says it's a mitzvah. So why is it a mitzvah? It doesn't say in the Torah. The Torah says, Pesach Matzah Maror. So it's only a mitzvah, the Rabbanan, if it's a mitzvah at all. And just from general knowledge, why do we say that it's a mitzvah? What does it represent?
The mortar.
The mortar, right? Bricks. Simple question, that's all. Next. Question number 13 brings us to the end of the Mishnah. The Mishnah says at the end, Uva Mikdash Hayu Mivim Lefanav Gufo Shel HaPesach. In the Mikdash, they used to bring Lefanav before him Gufo Shel Pesach. Right? Remember, I pointed out many times that in the Mishnah, Shel is a prefix, Shel HaPesach, whereas in our language, our Man Hebrew, it's a separate word, Shel. Pesach.
I wonder if that's to save the printing. It's more convenient to save the lamed.
According to Professor Albeck, it's not something that came about with the invention of the printing press. It's rather part of the original grammar of the language. And of course, all other prepositions are also prefixes.
Right.
The bet, the lamed,
right,
the hay.
Yeah, so that makes sense. That if right. It's a prefix, it's consistent.
But also the word ale is two, and the lamed is used as a prefix for two.
Right. Yeah.
It's just it's like we slur things together in our spoken language. We put an apostrophe to denote a missing letter. Isn't that all it is?
Yeah, and the same thing with min, meaning from, becomes mem. And by the way, the hey, they say in original Hebrew it was hey lamed. It was hey lamed. And there's actually one or two places in the Torah in which you have hey lamed. Halazeh.
Yeah.
That.
Halazeh. Right.
But the shel never became just one letter. It's always two letters. And even when it's a prefix, it's still two letters. It doesn't become one letter.
A shin, you mean that?
Shin lamed. This is shin lamed, meaning of.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. But you can't make it, you can say lamed sometimes and mean shell.
Say it again?
You can say lamed and that can mean shell.
Oh, that's a very good point.
Yeah, that's interesting. It could be that the shin drops off somehow.
Oh,
the shin drops
off. I never thought of that.
They keep on dropping things off.
Never thought of that.
Slowly.
Like we say, for example, Hamishnah Torah L'Rambam.
Yeah.
Meaning the Mishnah Torah of the Rambam.
Which is really
with the Lamed. I never thought of that.
So in English sometimes too, you'll say something belongs to something, you'll just say, I can't think of an example.
Uh-huh. It's possible that comes from the shell. The shin drops off.
I never thought of that. That's a gold star of a certain type. That's like a...
going around.
Okay.
But it happens in a lot of languages. Like in French, you know, you'd say l'homme, you know, the man, you know, if it's mm-hmm. if the sound is redundant.
Right.
So here's a difficult question. It requires a little bit of thought. No outside information, just thought. This last phrase of about six words in the Mishnah, v'mikdash hayu mivim lefanav gufo shel Pesach. So I asked concerning that phrase in our question sheet. I asked in question 13, what is the meaning of the phrase v'mikdash? Don't answer so quickly. Just think. What does it mean Bamikdash. Literally, it means in the Mikdash. What does that mean?
In the time of the temple?
Ah, so you made it into a chronological statement, and that's certainly possible. Is there a different way of understanding it? Certainly possible. Say it again?
In the Mishkan.
What did you say?
In the Mishkan.
I'm not asking what the word Mikdash means. I'm asking basically what the word Ba means. It's defining it. And Brooks claims it means in the time of the Mikdash, whatever Mikdash means. Mishkan, well, it doesn't actually mean Mishkan. We're not going back that far. It means, you say, in the time of the Mikdash.
And the other possibility is it's a physical description.
Right.
In.
And what would in mean? There's also two possibilities. If it means in the time of, understand that there are two different time frames, the time of the Mikdash, and afterwards there's no Mikdash. If there's no Mikdash, there's no Korban Pesach. Fine. So Eric says that all that's possible. It might not be chronological, it might be geographical. And if it's geographical, it means in the Mikdash. But then what does that mean? What does in the Mikdash mean? I think there's two possibilities. It could mean literally in the Mikdash, or it could mean
Jerusalem.
In the Ir HaMikdash.
Yeah.
So you actually have three possibilities here. It means in the time of the Mikdash, or it means in the building of the Mikdash, or it means in the city of the Mikdash. Two of them are geographical, and one of them is chronological. So now, I'll ask, in the wording of our Mishnah, who's right? In the way our Mishnah is worded, there's proof that one of the three is right and the other two are wrong.
Well, first of all, it says, I think they didn't have the Seder meal in the Mikdash. And so it couldn't mean in the building.
Okay, you're probably right. But in the wording of the Mishnah.
Time, I think in the time, because after the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, you didn't have the Korban Pesach.
You're right, but in the wording of the Mishnah, what's the proof? There's one word that proves that one of the three is...
Ha'u.
Right.
They used to.
Gold star.
Ha'u. Right, that's a third gold star. I think that's three already. What happened to your three gold stars?
Chazak.
Wait, where does it say Ha'u? Ha'u Mevi'im Lefanav Gufa.
Right.
So it's describing...
But Mikdash Ha'u, they used to bring.
Yeah, yeah.
So it sounds like a chronological statement, which means Brooks is right. Now turn over the piece of paper and look
at... Is it a gold star?
You're right. It's a gold star.
That's
how
you flying today.
Talmud.
So now look at the Talmud Yerushalmi and discover the difference in the wording. I'll leave that for you to do.
If you listen up, you Mikdash Mevi'im. It's without the Hayu.
Right, Eric found it too quickly. Yeah. Didn't give others a chance to...
He's our linguist.
No Hayu.
Right, the last five words, actually it's the last six words, of the Mishnah, Uva Mikdash Mivi'in Lefanav Gufo Shel Pesach. In the Mikdash, they bring before him the carcass of the Pesach, and the word Hayu is missing. It's in the present tense. It's the present participle. In the Mikdash, they bring before him the Gufo Shel Pesach. So although Brooks got a gold star in the context of the Nusach, the wording of our Mishnah, as it's printed in what I brought for you, but in the Yerushalmi, the wording is different, which means that the interpretation of the word Mikdash might be different. Although in our Mishnah, as we saw it earlier, Mikdash means the time of the Mikdash, but in the wording of the Yerushalmi, it does not necessarily mean the time of the Mikdash. It either means in the building of the Mikdash or in the city of the Mikdash, which would mean that the Mishnah is telling us, according to the Yerushalmi, that if you live in the time of the temple, then if you're in the building or the city of the temple, they would bring before you the body of the Korban. But if you're in the time of the temple, but not in the temple, or not in the city of the temple, they wouldn't bring you the Korban, because you only bring the Korban in Yerushalayim. So it could very well be that what's at issue in the Mishnah as we're reading Yerushalmi is not chronology, it's geography. And it's telling you that making the Seder, when there's a Mikdash, that's a given, it doesn't say that, but if you're in the Mikdash, X, if you're not in the Mikdash, then you don't get the Korban Pesach. And then once we say we're talking about geography and not chronology, we get back to the question, which geography? Is it in the Mikdash itself or in the city of the Mikdash? So David's right, the halacha is it's in the city of the Mikdash. But it's pointed out that in Sefer Yovlim, the Book of Jubilees, which goes back 200 years before the Common Era, it seems to say that the Korban Pesach was eaten actually in the Mikdash itself. That within the big Azara, the big courtyard, there had a million people sitting down and eating the Korban Pesach. How could that be? I'm not sure. Because it's not just a million people, it's all their families. So I'm not sure, but it seems to say from the Book of Jubilees that they ate the Korban Pesach in the courtyard of the temple itself.
Mostly on the floor, not on the high table.
Certainly on the floor, right. There would be no room for tables.
Wasn't that one of the miracles they tell about the Beit HaMikdash? No matter how many people came, there was always room.
Okay.
That was like yesterday.
Yesterday.
For the Tu B'Shvat Seder.
Oh, I was not feeling well, so I was.
Oh, oh.
That's why there was room, because I wasn't here.
It's a miracle. I don't see how it can refer to the city. I know the halacha is that it refers to the city, but
right.
In the Mikdash, how can you...
It's not the only place in the Mishnah that the word Mikdash refers to Ir HaMikdash. Okay. For example, if I'm not mistaken, so I have Masechet Rosh Hashanah here concerning the blowing of the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Let's see. 303. Good point, but let's see if I'm right about this. 303. Okay, so Masechet Rosh Hashanah, chapter 4. Yeah. Chapter 4 of Masechet Rosh Hashanah says, Yom Tov Shel Rosh Hashanah Shachaliot B'Shabbat.
Mm-hmm.
When Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbat, B'Mikdash Hayu Tokim, Aval Lo B'Midina.
Right.
In the Mikdash they would blow, but not in the Midina. The Midina is every other place. There's a halakha that you have to blow Shofar on Rosh Hashanah, but there's a rabbinic prohibition against blowing Shofar when Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbat, lest you carry it. Carry the shofar. And the Mishnah says that there is one place that you blow the Mishnah.
Oh, the shofar.
Blow the shofar, even on Rosh Hashanah Tefillah and Shabbat, where in the Mikdash.
Mikdash.
And here, the commentators say it means in Jerusalem. It doesn't mean in the building itself.
Right. Because of the juxtaposition, I think because of Medina.
The question was, Medina, does Medina mean any place that's not the building of the Mikdash, or any place that's not the city of the Mikdash?
The city.
So, as far as certain, the halakha is... here you have it. Professor Albeck says, what does Mikdash mean? The Makoma Mikdash Hainu B'chol Yushalayim. In the place of the Mikdash, did it say, of Yushalayim? That's the way other commentators understand. So, our Mishnah is not the only place that Mikdash means Ir HaMikdash.
Which means we can blow it here, since we are not in Yerushalayim.
Which means we can't blow it here.
Yeah.
Or in Yerushalayim.
So does this halakha, is it true today? There's a machloket whether we blow this, the shofar and shonah that falls on Shabbat in Jerusalem today or not. And the custom is not to do it, but in the 1930s,
Rabbi Schlesinger did
it. It was blown by Rabbi Akiva Schlesinger. He blew the shofar in Yerushalayim on Shabbat, but he did it in a bomb shelter so no one would hear.
It is not related to you.
It's not related to me.
You but not know.
He's as mischievous as I am.
Right, right.
Okay. So, we're talking now about the fact that in the Mikdash they brought before him the Pesach. Oh, so I want to point out the following. It's always interesting, and it's especially interesting in our chapter, to try and figure out when this was written, when this whole chapter was written. So, when Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi organized and edited the Mishnah in about the year 200 of the Common Era, in the vast majority of cases, he used pre-existing materials. He didn't write the Mishnah in the sense of sitting down and figuring out word for word. What he did is he edited Kvatsei Braitot, collections of rabbinic sources that came from tens of different Bate Midrash around the country from many different periods. There might have been Torah Shebal Peh material that had been passed down from Moshe, passed down from Yeshua, passed down from the times of the prophets, and it was passed down almost word for word. And all that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi did is take those words and put into the Mishnah. In other places, there might have been halachot that were, that hitchatshu, that were innovated since the time of the destruction of the temple, 100 years before him, 50 years before him, and that material he also took and put in the Mishnah. There might have been material that was being discussed in his day and didn't have any precedence, and he took from his day. Now, the historical researchers have many different reasons to say that our chapter of Mishnah is more or less something Rabbi Hanasi took as it is, a unit that existed hundreds of years before him, and just put it into the Mishnah. Now, this is material from the time of the Mikdash. That's what most historians say. There are no Hachamim mentioned here who lived later than the Mikdash. Rabbi Elazar Bar Tzadok, mentioned here, lived in the time of Mikdash. Later, Rabbi Gamliel will be mentioned. He lived in the time of the Mikdash. There are no later Hachamim mentioned in this chapter. Not Rabbi Akiba, who lived 70 years after the Mikdash, right? Not Rabbi Meir, not Rabbi Yehuda. They're not mentioned here.
So you're saying that there's very little innovation. This is more like the Masorah being transmitted.
This is probably a Masorah of hundreds of years before Rabbi Danasi. And in that context, we get to the question of the word Hayu, that David pointed out, they used to. So the historians say that probably the girsa, the text in the Yerushalmi, is the proper girsa. Over Mikdash Mivim, in the Mikdash, they bring before him the Gufo Shel Pesach. And it's saying, here we are, in the year 200 before the Common Era, or the year 100 before the Common Era, or the year 100 of the or year 0, or the year 50, we have a Mikdash. And it says, if you do your Seder in the Mikdash, they bring before him the Gufo Shel Pesach. If you do your Seder in Ashkelon, right, or in Haifa, then they don't bring before him the Gufo Shel Pesach. But it's not talking about something that used to be done. It's talking about what we do today. Today, at the time of the Mikdash, they bring before him the Pesach if they're in the Mikdash, and they don't bring it before him if not in the Mikdash. And that brings us back to the matter of Shnei Tavshilim. It was mentioned early in the Mishnah, in line 2 in the middle of the line. It said they brought before him the Matzah, the Chazeret, and the Charoset, and two dishes. You know what those two dishes are for?
I don't.
Says one here, one is for the Hagiga and one is
right.
For the...
Right. They are in place of the Korban. Today we use a shank bone and an egg. Those are the two dishes. The shank bone represents the Korban Pesach, and the egg represents the Korban Hagiga. Korban Hagiga is a Korban brought on all of the three holidays. So, if you're... Just let me finish the thought. If you're in the Mikdash, they brought before him the Korban Pesach, and it doesn't say it, but they also brought the Korban Chagigah. If you're not in the Mikdash, they brought Shnei Tavshilim, two dishes. So the words two dishes might not be in the original wording of the Mishnah. And I don't remember how it is in the Yerushalmi. Look in the Yerushalmi that I printed for you. Does it say there Tavshilim? It doesn't. Right, notice that. Notice the wording in Yerushalmi. We're turning the page to the back of the page. Hayu lefanav yirakot v'chazeret. They brought before him yirakot or romaine lettuce. Mitabel v'chazeret ad shumagila paperet apat. He dips with the romaine lettuce before you even get to the paperet apat. Last five words of the first line, David, of the Yerushalmi, Hiviu lefanav matzah v'charoset v'chazeret v'charoset. They brought before him matzah and romaine lettuce and charoset afapi she'ein charoset mitzvah. What's missing? It doesn't say they brought two tavshilim. Because that's probably the original wording. It doesn't say hayu, and it doesn't say shnei tavshilim, because they really were bringing before him the gufo shel Pesach. It's only if you're not in the Mikdash that they would bring Shnei Tavshilin.
You mean the time of, if you're after
during
the
time of the Mikdash, uh-huh. Right.
If you're living after
Well,
seven.
Even if you're, I think, that's what I'm not sure, but I think that even if, no, I'm not, I'm really not sure. I'm really not
even
sure
if
about
you're
that.
Lifting before
it could be it's just a later minhag to bring the two Tavshilin, I'm not sure.
So
that goes my question.
Yeah, sorry, your question.
The egg, when did it start? When did we start using the egg? The egg was not in the original.
The Talmud says that you could use anything for the two Tavshilim. The opinion of Rabbi Zera is beets and rice. When the custom of using a shankbo neg developed, I don't know. You know, shank bone, there's even a machloket if we actually bring the bone of a animal or use a chicken wing. Anyone has seen a chicken wing used?
Yes.
No.
Yes. I have.
What have you guys seen used? Something from a
beef.
Cow?
Yeah.
Beef.
Yeah,
beef.
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 Yeah. Anyone see lamb used, by the way?
Yes, of course.
It's actually a machlok, if you like to use lamb bone, because it's so similar to the korban, you might get it mixed up, that uh-huh. Think it really is a korban. There's a machlok if you can use a lamb bone.
And the egg should be roasted, too.
The egg should be roasted because it's representative of a korban.
Right.
So you ask yourself, why use an egg if it's representative of a korban? I don't know, but again, the Gemara says you can use beets and rice.
I want to follow that one.
Maybe beets, the blood, I don't know.
Perhaps because they didn't have money
for the round.
Nowadays, it's a Sephardic custom.
Well, that shows you that they were an Ashkenazim in the Gemara, right? They had Rex and Pesach.
And the beets round, like I mean, they're already thinking about that symbolism.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know how the egg said it, but
I still remember when I was a little kid, we went to a model Seder in a Reform temple. And the rabbi said that we used an egg because it reminded us of Paro's hard head. And I didn't say that to make fun.
And if it does?
No. Yeah,
that's fine, right?
It's a nice symbolism.
Yes.
Yeah. So I understand that the Talmud Yerushalmi probably was written in the time of the temple, right?
No.
It was not.
We're not talking here about the time of Talmud Yerushalmi. That's not the question.
Because it was written in the Common Era, I guess.
Yeah, the Talmud Yerushalmi was written between the years 200 and 400 of the Common Era.
Okay.
It's just the following. The Mishnah copied in manuscripts.
Was it way after the destruction of the temple?
Slow down. The Mishnah we know was edited in the year 200. And after the Mishnah we have the Talmud Yerushalmi between the years 200 and 400, and then we have the Talmud Bavli between the years of 200 and 500 when they were edited. Both the Talmud Yerushalmi and Talmud Bavli include within them the Mishnah. So once you get to the year 500, I'm simplifying, you have three different manuscripts in the Jewish world. The manuscript of the Mishnah separately, a manuscript of the Talmud Yerushalmi that has in it the Mishnah, and a manuscript of the Talmud Bavli that has in it the Mishnah. Now these three manuscripts were each copied by copyists, by copyists, hundreds of times, till we get to the printing press. And then they were printed. When manuscripts are copied, mistakes develop. Words are added, words are subtracted. Each of these three manuscripts branched off, and each of them was copied hundreds of times. So you have 300 copies of the Mishnah, and 300 of the Mishnah in the Yerushalmi, and 300 of the Mishnah in the Bavli, three different textual traditions, and each of them develops its own mistakes and its own history. And historians actually try and develop the family trees of manuscripts, how they develop, and seeing how mistakes developed, and this one came from this country, and this one developed with a mistake here. One manuscript came to Provence, and a certain mistake there, and all those copied from this one have this mistake. The manuscript that went to this country had et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
The same with DNA, mutations.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Right. So we have three different textual traditions of the Mishnah. the three textual traditions, the one that was copied the most amount of times is the Babli. The one that was copied the least amount of times is the Yerushalmi. The one that's in the middle is the Mishnah. So the Yerushalmi was copied the least amount of times because it was learned the least. And therefore, when the printing press was invented, there were very few copies of the Yerushalmi to print from. And when we have a possible mistake in the Yerushalmi, we have very few manuscripts to compare to. But on the other hand, since the Yerushalmi was copied the least amount of times, it's sometimes the most
authentic
text. Sometimes. So in our particular case, it looks like, we're guessing, it looks like the Yerushalmi's text of the Mishnah is the most authentic text. Looks like. You can never be certain, especially since I'm not a historian. You have people who their whole profession, their whole professional interest is the history of a certain text. Not the content of it, just the history of it. It's a fascinating subject. Oh, by the way, there was a little article in the Jerusalem Post just last week that didn't make the headlines, but it said that the Vatican just released 700 Jewish manuscripts that have never been seen by Jewish scholars ever.
Oh.
Wow. In other words, just to give some background to this.
In the basement.
In the basement of the Vatican.
Wow.
So the story goes like this, that during the course of the Middle Ages, we know that the church initiated literally tens upon tens of manuscript burning parties. They burned the Gemara, they burned the Mishnah, they burned everything. At the same time that the Vatican burned the Talmud, literally tens of thousands of copies over the course of 1,000 years, the Vatican also hoarded copies of Jewish texts for the purpose of study by Franciscan and Dominican friars to use in disputations, use them out in disputations against the Jews. Now, the Jewish people, until the year 1925, the Jewish people didn't have a national library. Our manuscripts were either burned or confiscated by the church, or they were kept in private libraries, which sometimes burned down, and sometimes things happened. We didn't have a good way to keep our manuscripts. Where were our manuscripts preserved? Those who were taken...
Alexandria.
Not in Alexandria. That library burned down. Those that were confiscated by different European monarchies. We have a lot of Jewish manuscripts in the Bodleian Library in England, and many in St. Petersburg, and in Munich, and in the church, and in the Vatican. All of those other libraries released their manuscripts to Jewish scholars in the past 100 years, except the Vatican. And this just came out last week, that after years of negotiations, 700 manuscripts were released. This is going to change the world of Jewish scholarship. We will find their texts that we didn't know about, whole books that have been lost. We'll find their, who knows, we'll find the comment of the Rambam to the Shas, I don't know, you know, that we did, that was lost, we never knew about. But we'll certainly find texts of the Yerushalmi and of the Babli and the Mishnah, and new books will be written and articles, and it's a wonderful, wonderful break for the crew. And it was just a little article. I don't even know if it didn't reach the front pages. Yeah. It's like a major, major
Rashi
thing.
Does Rashi interpret also Talmud Yerushalmi? Rashi?
Not that I know of.
It doesn't
Not
have enough. Rashi there.
We don't know of any Rishonim that wrote commentaries on the Yerushalmi except for the Rambam. And the Rambam's commentary was basically lost.
Uh-huh.
We think you wrote a commentary on the Yerushalmi.
There is no Rashi, you didn't tell me.
There's no Rashi.
They are losing.
No. Say it again?
I said they are losing. They will keep on losing.
We lost, but now we're gaining.
Right.
No, I mean they, not us. And we lost, but we are gaining. They will keep on losing until they get tired of losing.
Ah.
They will give up.
When are they going to give the ark back?
Ask Wendell James.
They don't have it.
So are they being transported to Yerushalayim somewhere?
Yeah, it was just those little articles. Didn't say anything.
You have to believe it's being made available to scholars.
I think today, by the way, JTS has one of the largest
today, the largest libraries in the world, the Jewish manuscripts of the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York and in Jerusalem in the National Library. Okay.
That's say good news.
Yes, it's good news. Okay, so now, where are we now? We've talked about that when this Mishnah was probably formulated. It's probably from pre-Mikdash times. I'm sorry, pre-destruction times. We talked about the Nusach there, the wording. Let's see if there's any questions left to do. Okay. I'm just looking what we have left to do here. Okay. Fine. We are going to look at some source on the back of the page, and then we're going to spend the last 20 minutes on a major, major issue. So let's look at the first source on the back of the page. No, I'm sorry, the third. The third says, it's from the Talmud Bavli, Masechet Pesachim, Daf Kuf Yudal Zemud Bet. V'tekamar Tre Tibule Lameli, and that which you said, two dippings, why to me? Why do we have two dippings? It's enough to have one dipping when you actually take the maror, which is the mitzvah of maror, which you eat with the matzah and the korban Pesach, and you dip it in charoset. That's the mitzvah of the night, maror, Pesach, and matzah. Why do we have to have a dipping before that? And our Mishnah talks about a first dipping. Why do you need that? And it says, ki hechi de lahave hekera letinokot. Ki hechi means in order that, de lahave, it will be, a hekera, a noticeability, is not a good English word to translate that, a noticeability for the tinokot. Tinokot doesn't mean babies, it means children. In other words, the Talmud claims the only reason we have a dipping before the dipping, only reason we have in our Mishnah, he viu lefanav, they brought before him, and he dips in chazeret, even before you get to the mitzvot, is so the kids will ask, why are you doing it? That answer should be suspect. Right? Whenever you say we're doing something so you'll ask why did I do it, you ask yourself, but why particularly that and not standing on your head? Hmm. Might there be a different reason why we did it? And perhaps we've forgotten the reason. So look at the Bayit Chadash, the Bach, who is a commentary on the Torah, and he can't hear, it comes close probably to hitting on the real historical reason for the first dipping. He says, Hatibul shekodem suda hu derech herut. The dipping that is before the meal, in other words, what we call the first dipping, is derech herut. It's by way of freedom. Kederech b'nei chorin. I'm sorry, I have a misprint there. It should be shemitabilin. I wrote an aleph instead of the taf. Yeah. But a tet.
Hey, it's missing a tet.
Missing a tet, right? Shematbilin.
Yeah.
Kodem suda lamshich tavata machal. It's the way of free people who dip before their meal.
Yeah.
Lamshich means, in this case, to arouse.
To extend or something.
To arouse.
To arouse. Uh-huh.
To arouse. The passion for eating.
The desire to eat.
Right, in other words, appetite.
It makes them hungry.
To cause
that makes sense. Appetizers. Salt certainly.
Appetizers, right. So it seems to be a simple thing, and we have tens upon tens of historical witnesses to this. In the time of the Talmud, the aristocracy would lie on their couches before the meal and dip foods. They would bring around different foods to
eat
be dipped.
Vegetables. You know,
vegetables, like, right.
It's Roman custom.
And exactly right. It's a Hellenistic custom. It's nothing specifically Jewish. And apparently, when the whole Seder began to develop, the Hachamim ruled that something that the aristocrats usually do, on this night, every Jew must do.
Yeah.
As a way of freedom. Just like we talked about the reclining. What the aristocrats would always do, on this night, even the Anisha of Yisrael has to do. He has to construct his meal as the free men do tonight. Remember, free men in Hellenistic society, only a small percentage of men were legally free, right? Were citizens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The aristocrats who had the money and the wherewithal to act freely in their meals, reclining and dipping. So this night we're commanded to act as they do in order to live out, to act out freedom. That's probably the original reason for the first dipping. When in the Talmud they no longer lived in Eretz Yisrael, they no longer lived within Hellenistic influence, they no longer had the custom of having dipping at the beginning of aristocratic meals. So the Gemara didn't know why we do it, but they still did it. So they said, why do we do it? So you would ask.
Right.
That's probably the history.
Anyway, we dipped in those days because we didn't have forks and knives. So we used our fingers to dip.
Okay, but they're asking, why do you dip even before the meal? You know, why they're appetizers. It's not the dipping thing. It's the fact that there are appetizers before you get to the meal. Yeah, so that's probably the reason why we have the first dipping historically, because that's Derech Herut, and later...
last meal.
And just to remind us, and the second one is...
The second dipping is dipping the maror in Haroset for the actual mitzvah of maror.
Uh-huh.
And is the Bach the only, or one of the only, or one of the few commentators that bring this explanation?
Tell you the truth, I don't remember. I learned this 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But all the historians point out that the Bach is probably historically right.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so now... just let me think. We did that. We want to do now the most important thing for today. The point of the whole thing, we have 20 or 25 minutes. It shouldn't take more than 10 minutes. And then perhaps we'll go back to the first Mishnah, the Gemara in the first Mishnah. The issue that we're going to talk about now is, when do we eat? When do we eat? In our Seder, when do we eat?
Late.
Late. Right, that's the answer. In our Seder, we have the first dipping, right? We dip the karpas in the salt water, and then we go on to basically mitzvat magid. We bring the tray of the Seder with the matzot, and the different Seder matters, and then we do the mitzvah of Magid. It begins with the four questions, and then we answer the questions, we tell the whole story, a whole drasha, and it goes on long and long and long, it goes on a long time, because of course it says in the Gemara that kol marbe l'saper b'yitziat Mitzrayim, all who go overboard in telling the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim, hareza mishubach, behold they are to be praised when we get to the meal in the middle of the night, and we're very hungry and very tired, and it's the wrong time to eat. The question is that, well, that custom doesn't seem to make too much sense. We pointed out last time that it certainly doesn't make sense in light of the first mission of the chapter. The first mission of the chapter says, go hungry Erev Pesach, so that you'll get into Pesach with an appetite in order to eat your matzah when you're hungry. But in today's custom, we eat the matzah only 3 hours later. Why did you have to go hungry 3 in the afternoon the day before? Doesn't seem to make any sense.
Starving.
We're starving. So if we look at our Mishnah, it doesn't say when we eat, but it does say when we bring the food. Right? It says, I'll read the whole Mishnah again. Hiviu lefanav mitabel bechazeret ad shemagia lepaperet apat. They brought before him vegetables, we said. And then you dip vegetables, and if you only have romaine lettuce, you dip romaine lettuce, even though this is before you get to the romaine lettuce that is part of the parperet apat. And then they bring before him matzah, right? Yiviu lefanav, last word of the first line, yiviu lefanav matzah, v'chazeret v'charoset u'shnei tavshilim. They bring before him the matzah, and the romaine lettuce, and the charoset, and the two dishes that represent the korban pesach and the korban chagiyah. We said they bring them if it's not in the mikdash, and they don't bring them if you have the korban pesach. Afal pi shein charoset mitzvah, even though the charoset is not a mitzvah, and the Rav Lissat says, Ben Tzadok says it's a mitzvah, and the mikdash they brought before in the pesach. So I want you to picture this: they bring the matzah and the maror and the charoset, and they bring this sizzling hot lamb chop from the fire. And what do you do with it? There's two possibilities. You eat it, or you wait 3 hours until it gets really, really cold and disgusting, and then you eat it. In other words, you eat it when you bring it. Just like the first Mishnah, the second Mishnah said you bring the wine and you say a bracha, didn't say you drink it, but you do.
Right.
This Mishnah doesn't say that you eat, but that's what you bring the food for, to eat.
That's the Ad Shemagia Lefaferet Apat? No.
First of all, there also, when it says they brought before him, you dip the lettuce, doesn't say you eat it, but you do. And it says they brought before him the matzah, haroset, chazeret, and the gufo shel Pesach, the body of the Pesach, doesn't say you eat it, but obviously you eat it when you bring it. Otherwise, what are you bringing it for? But more than that, I can't imagine that they brought this sizzling hot lamb and no one ate it until it got very, very cold. And many historians say that apparently in the time of the Mikdash, the first thing that happened this evening was the main mitzvah of the evening. One of the first things. They made kiddush, they had the appetizers, and then they brought the gufo shel Pesach and they ate it. Because that was the main mitzvah of the night, is to eat the Pesach with the matzah and with the maror. When you finish that, then they had the mitzvah of Sipur Yitzhak Mitzrayim. Which makes perfect sense. I want to understand why it makes perfect sense. In our way today, we, of course, begin Mitzvat Magid, the telling of the story, with the four questions. Before we eat, the way we do it today. What do we say in the four questions? The four questions, we say, for example, the first question. Why is this night different than all the nights? Why do we have matzah? That's a ridiculous question, because we ask it before we have matzah. Another question is, why do we only have maror tonight? What do you mean, we didn't have the maror yet? How do you know? The question is supposed to be a spontaneous question the kids ask. How can they ask if they didn't eat yet? In the time of the Mikdash, one of the questions was, why do we have a Pesach tonight? But if they're not eating it yet, how can you ask that question? Now, the questions don't make any sense the way we do them today. It's all contrived. That's why we teach the kids to say them, because they wouldn't say them spontaneously, because they don't know what they're going to eat. What happened at the time of the Mikdash was most probably they brought the Pesach Maror and Matzah and they ate it. And while they're eating it, the kids get up and say, why are we having Matzah? Why are we having Korban Pesach? Why are we having Maror? And then you start the story as the meal is winding down. That's the way it probably was in the time of the Mikdash. There's a number of proofs for this. I won't go into it. When I discovered this 20 years ago, I had to read a lot of ancient books that were written at the beginning of the previous century and all historical writings. I was so excited by this discovery, I used to take a whole class to talk about it. Now I'm less excited. I can talk about it in 5 minutes. But it's just it's a paradigm shift to understand that probably the Seder looked very different 2,000 years ago than it looks today. It was a real meal, and there were real questions concerning the real meal. There is a Gemara that says that tonight, at the Seder, what we have to do is chotfin et ha-matzot. Chotfin et ha-matzot. The verb is chotef, which means to grab.
To kidnap.
We grab the matzot. And there's a big machloket among the commentators. What does it mean to grab the matzot? A Rashi and the Rashbam is Rashi's grandson, say the following. Why do we grab the matzot? They say chotfin the matzot means ochlim meher, we eat quickly, kedei shatinokot yishalu, in order that the children will ask, why are you eating quickly? Okay? When I first learned that, I never understood. Why should you eat quickly so the children will ask? Because in our Seder, the children are sleeping by then. It's the middle of the night. They already asked before, and you told the story, now you're eating. Rather, the interpretation of Rashi and the Rashbam indicates that they were aware that in the time of the Mikdash, you ate before the Mitzvat Magid, before the questions, and you ate Meher, in their interpretation, in order to do something strange, so the kid will notice this meal is a different meal, so they'll ask. And the asking is while they're eating, leading up to the Mitzvat Magid that comes after you're eating.
It's one of the four questions.
Yeah. Right. Why are you eating a Pesach? Why are you eating matzah? Why are you eating so quickly?
We got to get out of town.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Right. Exactly.
So it's like a reenactment that leads into the...
Right, into the story. There are other proofs of this. In our Seder, we tell over a braita of the four hachamim who are sitting in Bnei Brak. Right? Rabbi Akiba, Rabbi Tarfon, who remembers who they are? Rabbi Elazar, and...
Tarshi?
And perhaps Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah?
Gamaliel.
Rabbi Gamaliel, perhaps. I'm not sure.
And then it gets light out.
You're going to get the light.
They stayed up all night. It got light out, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And it says they told the story all night until it got light out. That always bothered me because it means I forgot to eat.
Right.
And eating is a mitzvah.
But you have to understand.
But now we understand. They ate already. They ate at the beginning of the night, and then they sat back to tell the story until the sun came up. It makes perfect sense as long as you understand that the original order of things was to...
No. They weren't in Jerusalem, they were in Abraham.
Right. I was just about to say that. So that gets to the next point. So if they used to do things differently, they used to eat and have the Pesach Maron Morsar Lifnei Mitzvat Magid, before Mitzvat Magid, why was it changed? And the answer is simple. It was changed because of Chorban HaBayit, because of the destruction of the temple. When we have the temple and you have the Pesach is the major mitzvah of the night. It makes perfect sense to do it at the beginning of the evening. You do it together with Matzah and Maror. When the temple was destroyed, suddenly the meal of the night is no longer a mitzvah. You're going to have Matzah and Maror, those are mitzvot, but the meal that you're going to have, whatever you're going to eat, chicken or beets or rice, is not a mitzvah. It's just because you're hungry. We don't want to eat the meal before we get to the mitzvah of telling the story, because the meal is no longer a mitzvah. So probably that's when the order was reversed. And now we have this new custom of eating only after mitzvah magid. Mm-hmm. But what most probably happened is the change didn't happen overnight. It took hundreds of years for the change to be put into place. When Rabbi Akiva was in Bnei Brak at the beginning of the second century, it was after the Mikdash, but they still had the Mikdash custom. But at some point that was changed. We don't know when. We have no idea. It was changed 300 years after the destruction. 200, 500. We don't know that. So there are two other points that I just want to show how they fit in with this new understanding. One has to do with the whole structure of this chapter. Let's look at the whole structure of this chapter. We have been talking about the fact that this chapter goes according to the order of the night. Mishnah Bet talked about Kiddush. Mishnah Gimel that we learned today talked about the first appetizer and then bringing all the foods. Mishnah Daled talks about pouring the second glass of wine. And I'm claiming now we ate before that. Right? It talks about the second glass of wine. It talks about the Kan HaBen Shoel Aviv, and here the kid asks his father. We'll do this next week. And it gives us the four questions. I'm turning the page. And it goes to the whole story of Mitzvat Magid in Mishnah Hay, and Halel in Mishnah Vav. And Mishnah Zayin talks about Mazgulo Kos Shlishi, the third Kos, the Kos of Halel. And then Mishnah Chet says...
En Maftirin Achar Pesach.
Right, En Maftirin Achar Pesach HaPikomen, that's the very end, you don't eat anything at the end of the meal. And then look at Mishnah Tet. We're going to read Mishnah Tet. HaPesach Achar Chatzot Mitamei Et Yadayim. The Korban Pesach after midnight makes the hands ritually impure. We won't talk about that now. We'll do that in another few weeks. We're now skipping five words. Hapigul v'notar mitamim et yadayim. We'll skip them. Beirach birkata Pesach patar et shel zevach. If you said the blessing over the Pesach, you exempt the blessing over the zevach. The zevach is korban chagigah. Okay, that's all. The point I want to make is the last mishnah of the chapter talks about the korban Pesach. The blessing of the Korban Pesach. Okay? That's all you have to know. The last Mishnah of the chapter talks about the blessing of the Korban Pesach. This Mishnah is out of place. It's out of place. How do you know it's out of place? Because even if you say the meal is the last thing, like our custom today, still the previous Nishma Quartet said you don't eat anything after the Pesach. So why does it say after the Mishnah says you don't eat anything after the Pesach? Then it says the blessing over the Pesach. It's in the wrong place. Mishnah Tet talking about the eating of the Pesach was in the wrong place. So there are two questions. Where is the right place? And why is it in the wrong place? Okay? So the question of where is the right place, the answer to the question where is the right place is right after the Mishnah we learned today. In other words, what did we learn today? We learned today, Mishnah Gimel, that ended by saying, in the Mikdash, they bring before him the carcass of the Pesach. You with me? Mishnah Gimel, right?
Yeah.
Ended by saying, in the Mikdash, I'm taking out the word Hayu, in the Mikdash, they bring before him the body of the Pesach. Mm-hmm. And then I'm saying, should come Mishnah Tet that says, the blessing of the Pesach is, and now eat it. And eat it. Say the blessing and eat it. That's where the Mishnah belongs, according to my theory. It's not my theory, that we eat when we bring the food, as we've explained for the past 10 minutes. So we know where the Mishnah belongs. The question is, why is it not there?
But does this reflect more the order of our Seder?
No, it doesn't, because it's in the wrong place even now with Seder, remember? Because it comes after Ein Maftir and Achar Pesach Bikomen. But Eric is probably partially right. Probably, in the wake of the destruction of the temple, the Mishnah that talks about eating the Korban Pesach, they debated what to do with it. Right? We don't want to destroy it, but we do want to do something to indicate that that's not what's done anymore. So they took the Mishnah to the right place and put it at the end. At the very end, as if to say, this is an addendum to remind you what used to be done Bisman Beit Mikdash, in the time of the Mikdash. So those are probably the two answers to the questions. Question number one, where does the last Mishnah of the chapter belong? And question number two, why was it taken out from the place that it belongs? The last matter we'll deal with on this Mishnah is one of my favorites, and it's called the question of Akirat HaShulchan. Akirat HaShulchan. The custom of removal of the table. Some of you might have noticed that in the instructions for the Pesach Seder that we have today in our Haggadot, some Haggadot say it in this fashion, some in a different fashion, some of the Haggadot say that right before the four questions, in other words, right after bringing the matzot to the table, or right after uncovering them, which is a fulfillment of what the Mishnah we learned today says, they bring before him the matzah, chazeret, and charoset. Some of the Haggadot say that right then, before the kids ask the question, it says, you take away the matzot from the table. That custom of taking away the matzot is a remnant of the ancient custom of taking away the table at that point. There used to be a custom in the time of the Gemara that they would bring, as it says in our Mishnah, bring the appetizers, dip, then bring the matzah, chazer, and charoset, and then take it away. Bring it and take it away. And then the kids ask the questions.
Why?
Why? Thank you very much. Why? I'm happy you asked that question. So we're going to look at a Gemara that asks and answers, why do we bring the food and then take it away before eating? So it's on the back of the page. Okay. Lama okrina teshulchan. It's the last source I brought here. Lama okrina teshulchan. Why do we uproot the table? That's a literal translation of oker. Why do we uproot the table? Amri debe Rabbi Yanai, it was said in the house of study of Rabbi Yanai, Kadesh yakiru tinokot bishalu, in order that will recognize the children and ask. And why do you take the table away? So that children will ask, why did you take the table away?
It sounds familiar about the children.
Right. And like I said earlier, whenever you do something so that you'll ask, why did you do it? I suspect that there was a real reason earlier that was forgotten. Says the Gemara, Abaye havayateiv kamei derabba. Abaye was sitting in the presence of Rabba. Rabba is his adopted father. In this story, Abaye was a little boy, and his adopted father, who later became his teacher, is Rabba. Chaza dekam madle taka mikamei. Chaza, that's the word everyone knows.
He saw.
To see, like chazon, a vision. He saw dekam madle. Madle is the Aramaic word for oker. They were uprooting. Taka is the Aramaic word for table. He saw that they were taking away the table mikamei from before him. Remember they had these little tripod tables in front of everyone? He saw that they were taking away his table. Amarlahu, he said to them, Adayin loka achlinan. Still we have not yet eaten. We didn't eat yet. Atu kam akre taka mikman. And you are uprooting the tables from before us? We didn't eat yet and you're taking everything away? Amar le Rabba, said to him Rabba, the leader of the Seder, his adopted father, Patartan milomar manishtana, you have exempted us from saying manishtana. In other words, you were so perceptive in noticing the different changes we're doing tonight to arouse the children to ask, you don't have to ask any other questions, you did a good job.
Naturally.
And it seems to be saying that we take the table away before eating to get the kids to ask. Once they ask, great, we're great parents because we arrange things so the kids would be curious and they'd ask their own questions. Beautiful. But still the question is asked, where did this crazy custom come of taking the table away before we eat?
It's a whole lot of job.
Say it again?
That's too much to do.
No, it's not, because they had every person a little tripod in front of them that was the table. It's just easy to...